accession number 19858, reel 1.
Major French, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Bletchingley in Surrey.
Which year was this?
That was in 1930.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Bletchingley?
No, I went to private schools. Three preparatory schools. And then I went to Ampleforth College in Yorkshire. And then, of course, on to Sandhurst.
Why did you want to make a career of the army?
My main reason, my great interest, was because my uncle, that was my mother's brother, who was also a Royal Fusilier, had got the first Victoria Cross of the First World War, and he was killed in action at Mons on the first day of fighting.
Did you have any Second World War experiences that we could record, please?
Well, living in Surrey during the school holidays and that, I used to watch the Battle of Britain, and at the age of 10, one found that quite exciting, watching Spitfires shooting down German aeroplanes over Kenley and Purley and all along the North Downs there. I remember at my prep school, the Canadian divisional headquarters came on exercise before D-Day, and they were stationed in our gymnasium. And as all the Canadians were in fact stationed around us in Bletchingley, although my school was in Hertfordshire, one knew a lot of these Canadians. Some of them in fact were even billeted on us. So it was quite exciting at the age of 11 or something to see them suddenly appearing at the school.
What kind of impression did these Canadians make on you?
Oh, I mean, as a young boy, very exciting, because they took us out in their Bren gun carriers. And, you know, we had a tremendous day with them.
And how were they received by the local population?
Oh, very well. You see, there weren't any Americans stationed around there, so one only sort of heard of the Americans coming over in their vast numbers. But the Canadians were a very cheerful lot, and, you know, very good with children, and one used to go round on the back of motorcycles with their dispatch riders and that sort of thing. And in fact, when my father was very ill, in fact he died, the Canadian general tried to get penicillin, which wasn't available then, down to my father. But in fact, it was too late and he died. He was commanding the Home Guard because he was a farmer, slightly too old for the war.
Did any bombs fall near you during the Second World War?
The nearest one was in our garden. As I say, my father was a farmer and we were therefore living on a farm. But about 50 yards from the house, there was one bomb came down, cut the telephone wires, I think.
What was the address of the house?
The what of the house?
The address of the house. Address.
Oh, Place Farm. It was, in fact, the gatehouse of the palace that Henry VIII had given to Anne of Cleves. And that was all that remained of it, the gatehouse, and that's where we lived. But I think the bomb came down during the term time, so I wasn't actually there at the time. But then there was another bomb in a field further up, and there were two old squatters who lived in a hut in the wood, and she was wounded by the bomb, and she crawled. They were great drinkers, so she crawled about half a mile, a very old woman, to the pub after she'd been wounded.
What about life at Ampleforth during the Second World War?
I remember there King George VI coming round to inspect the Guards Armour Division, who was stationed in Lord Faversham's estate at Duncombe Park, and we all lined up for the king to drive past. And again, we used to see a lot of the ammunition stores that were lined up all along the side of the moor, the road, you know, across the North Yorkshire moors. But of course, being up there, one didn't really, you know, have the same contact with the war that one did down in Surrey.
Was the schooling, was the education at Ampleforth much affected by the war?
Not as much as in most schools, I don't think, because many of the teachers were, in fact, monks, of course, Benedictine monks. But I think, you know, like any school, it wasn't as good as it would have been had it not been for the war.
Can you tell me about the course that you had at Sandhurst, what you thought of it?
I thought it was great. I mean, I joined 6 months before I went to Sandhurst for my basic training, and that was down at Shorncliffe. And of course, having come from a fairly narrow public school environment, it was quite a thing to be thrown into a barrack room with soldiers from the East End of London and a complete mix, but it was very good for enabling one to really to grow up. And then I came down to, all the infantrymen who were going to Sandhurst came down to Warminster, to Nook Camp just down the road, and there were about 80 of us, and instead of all being together in a block, we were put in with sections of the Lancashire Fusiliers, who happened to be the demonstration battalion. So again, one got to know how the other half lived, and I think it's such a great pity that they don't do that now, because I mean those are the men that you're going to command, and one wants to understand them, and living in a barrack room for 3 or 4 months is the best way of doing it.
And then, what happened?
Then I went to Sandhurst in January '49. In those days, it was an 18-month course, and I suppose it was about half academic and half military. One had quite a good social life, and physically, of course, it was very tough. But at the age of 18, 19, one thoroughly enjoyed it. And I mean, one remembers many of the characters from Sandhurst, particularly, I suppose, Regimental Sergeant Major Jesus Christ Lord, who I'm sure you know all about, and a most imposing figure. The Commandant was General Sir Hugh Stockwell, and he used to ride round on a little motorbike with his two stars as a Major General on the back. My company commander and my instructors were, of course, all officers who had been in the war, and so they were able to impart all their own experience and things like that. And then finally, in July 1950, we had our great passing out parade. Our parade was taken by, I think it was, yes, it was Field Marshal Slim, who was then Chief of the Imperial General Staff. And after that, I was then posted to the Royal Fusiliers 1st Battalion. Well, we only had one battalion then. That was in Berlin. And so I was a platoon commander in Berlin for 6 or 8 months, something like that. And I think my main memories there were the excitement of actually joining one's own regiment and a regiment that one's family had been in. My uncle, who I mentioned, the Victoria Cross one, and my great uncle had also been a Royal Fusilier. Spandau Prison, I think in my first 2 weeks, I was sent down with my platoon to guard, I think in those days there were about 7 or 8 imprisoned there, Hess and the others. And that made quite an impression, going round and not being able to talk to them, I always thought was so sad, because, you know, looking back on it, one could have learned quite a lot had one been allowed to, but obviously one wasn't.
And just going back to Sandhurst, have you any memories of Sergeant Major Lord, what he was like?
Well, an absolutely terrifying man to a young 18-year-old. There was this fantastic grenadier, 6'6", but really kind at heart. And he, I think, made more of an impression on me than any of the officers. The sergeant major of my company, I was at Ypres Company, was a really good Scotsman called Sergeant Major Rieck, and he threw the hammer, I think, for the army, and he was, again, a great sort of inspiration. Some of the senior cadets in one's junior term, one thought were pretty poisonous, because they were, you know, rather like sort of monitors at school throwing their weight around, but then eventually one moved up in the line and one saw, you know, that that was the way the thing was structured. I think I didn't end up as an under officer. I think I ended up as a cadet corporal or cadet sergeant or something.
So, what happened after Berlin?
After Berlin, the battalion was sent down to Iserlohn, the British Army of the Rhine, and that would have been in about 1951, in the spring or summer of 51, and we were there for just under a year. Nothing of great interest happened then. I came over on an anti-tank course when I was made the anti-tank platoon commander, and that was at Netherhaven down the road from here. And then early in 51 or mid 51, something like that, we were then told that the following year we were going to Korea. And so at the beginning of 52, we came back to England, really to gather ourselves up to get on the troop ship.
Can you tell me about the voyage out there, please?
We went out on the Empire Halidale, I think it was called. It was a long voyage, as they were. I suppose it was about 6 or 7 weeks. We did quite a lot of training, what one could, on a ship of that sort, mainly firing our weapons over the side at targets. PT, games. I think the thing that made most impression on me was the appalling conditions that the fusiliers lived in below decks in these hammocks that they had to sling, whereas the officers were in cabins. Okay, the cabins might have been a bit cramped, but, you know, we ate very well. Well, I think the fusiliers ate very well, but it was the conditions that they had to suffer from, really, and the appalling heat of the Red Sea and things. And I think, you know, the officers were rather unlucky, but that was the way that things worked in those days. We called in all the usual places, like, of course, there were places that one had never been to or really heard much about, like, you know, the Suez Canal, Port Suez, when the little bumboats came out and the boys used to sell the fruit, or they used to dive for pennies and things like that. So all that was quite exciting. Then on down to Aden, across to Ceylon, where I think we spent 24 hours, and that was marvellous, you know, going to a wonderful hotel and swimming in the Indian Ocean. Then on to Singapore, where there was a Royal Fusilier, there was a colonel out there called Peter Ashburner, who had commanded the battalion, in fact, and he was on the staff there, and he met us and showed us all round. Then we went on to Hong Kong, and I had connections there with the Keswick family. He was the chairman of Jardine Matheson's, and so he and his wife said, you know, come ashore with all your friends. And the last minute. In fact, they couldn't entertain us, but they said, go to this restaurant, send the bill to Jardine and Matheson's. And so 10 of us went to this fantastic meal, you know, and we thought the bill was about equivalent of 10 years' pay or something each. Anyway, that was the last port of call, and then on to Busan, where, like all the Italians that arrived out there from any of the United Nations, we were met by a large colored American band who sort of played us ashore. Then we got into trains, pretty scruffy trains. I remember there was a sign in the loo there that said, it said, no good standing on the seat, crabs in this train reach 10 feet. And anyway, we then chugged up for, I don't know how far, to Seoul, and I think then we must have got into a transport and went to a camp to start our, well, the indoctrination training for the theatre.
What did that involve?
That was about 2 weeks or so before we went into the line, and the main involvement really was to get fit, partly because of having, of course, been on the ship for 6 weeks. So every morning, the whole battalion, led by our commanding officer, who was Colonel Dick Stevens, we ran up to the top of one of these whacking great hills in Korea before breakfast and down again. And then there was all the normal training. One particular thing I remember is, although I was the anti-tank platoon commander, there was no requirement for, we had 17 pounders, there was no requirement for anti-tank guns at that stage because there was no threat from Chinese armor. And so I converted my platoon of, I suppose, about 80, 90 men, something like that, into ordinary infantrymen. I mean, many of them and myself, we'd had infantry training anyway, but for the last year or so, particularly in Germany, of course, we'd been concentrating on the anti-tank role, so we had the need to become ordinary infantrymen. And I remember on one occasion getting my fusiliers to walk blindfold almost, and if not blindfold, at night particularly, because one knew that most of the operations were going to be at night, to walk along the paddy buns, balancing on them without falling off into the water on either side. And one of my commanders, I can't remember, it might have been the commanding officer or the company commander, came and said, you know, you're wasting your time. What on earth are you doing? This isn't military training at all. So I had a bit of an argument with him, and I said, well, you know, when we go out on patrol, it's absolutely essential that we're quiet. And we've got to learn to balance on these paddy buns. And so I think that was accepted. Then anyway, after about 2 or 3 weeks indoctrination, we then went into the line.
What part of the line was it?
My particular platoon, or half company, of about 100 men, were put on the extreme left flank, the fusiliers, of course, being part of the Commonwealth Division, on the extreme left flank of the battalion, and this was in the Samichon Valley, which, as you know, is the traditional invasion route from the north. On our left, but somewhere away, and I didn't actually really see much of them, was a Turkish battalion, and we heard stories of them, how when they captured any Chinese, they would chop off their ears and keep them as souvenirs. I remember going up into the line, I think it must have been the day before we actually occupied the position. I went up with the commanding officer and I think my company commander. Although I did command a half company, my company commander was in fact also the battle adjutant. So I really worked as the other company commanders would, although I was only 22 years old, direct to the commanding officer. So he came up to see what my hill was going to be like. And on the way up, I always remember there was some quite heavy shelling going on. And the two or three other officers with me had all, of course, been through the war and knew what this was like. And they, probably very sensibly, threw themselves on flat on the ground. I thought this was rather sort of unbecoming, and I didn't. And I mean, it was arrogance, I think, rather than bravery. But anyway, they said, you know, when you're shelled, for God's sake, line up. So anyway, we then went up, and I met my opposite number from the King's KSLI, who we were taking over from, and I was surprised to find that he was a cavalryman, rather than infantryman, commanding these KSLI soldiers. So I said, why are you here as a cavalryman? Can't remember his regiment, but I think it was the Skins in the Skilling Dragoon Guards. I think that was it. And he said, oh, I'm commanding them because I had an argument with my squadron leader about tactics or whatever. And he thought I was in the wrong. So as a sort of punishment, I was sent to... sent as an infantryman for 3 months, a platoon commander. And he was obviously a very able chap. And the infantryman, you know, looked up to him as a young captain in the cavalry, commanded them and got on very well. So I spent 24 hours with him. And then my platoon moved up and took over.
What kind of advice did he give you in that 24 hours?
Well, I mean, he took me all round the platoon position, explained the minefields, fields of fire, the way he'd played it, which was, I mean, of course, completely a night war, dug in the trenches, and a completely static war other than patrolling. So he showed me the layout and everything, and he said how his battalion had done their patrols, and I mean, perhaps we were going to do it differently. Introduced me, I think, to the tank, because we had Centurion up in our position quite near, which was, of course, very useful, as well as being able to call down artillery and mortar fire. Our own mortars, or the New Zealand gunners who supported us. It was also very useful having one of these Centurions that could let fly at a bunker or something like that on the other side of the Samitron Valley where the Chinese were dug in. This chap, in fact, his name was General Sir Robin Carnegie, and he later became a fairly famous general in the army, and I met him finally about 30 years later, which was quite fun.
You were just about to tell me what happened after this 24 hours briefing.
Well, after that, then my platoon was brought up by the platoon sergeant, and that was Sergeant Farrer, who was a big man with a big moustache. He'd been my sergeant in the anti-tank platoon. He had had experience of the war. I think a few of the corporals might have been in the war, but perhaps only just one or two, and very few of the men. We were, of course, a mixture of regulars, national service, and some older reservists. And although we were a Cockney regiment from the East End of London, we did also have particularly amongst the reservists, quite a few from, really, Norfolk, Suffolk, you know, whatever, different places. But we were basically Cockneys. And they were, you know, a very good bunch. The National Service, of course, were there because they were National Service. And I should think that well over 50% of the platoon probably was National Service. but they blended in perfectly well with the regulars, and you couldn't tell. I mean, I knew, of course, because I knew all my men, but otherwise you couldn't possibly tell who was a regular and who was a national serviceman, other than the corporals and so on, who were obviously, for the most part, were regulars. And the spirit, of course, like I suppose in any battalion, as one was living so close together under, I suppose you'd call it, stressful conditions, was very good, because you had the platoon spirit and your company spirit, and particularly the spirit of the regiment, which had been in existence since 1685. And all the soldiers, all the fusiliers, were imbued with that regimental spirit, and they were able to think of that only, I think, in a sort of vague way. But the real spirit that they showed was being able to be really friendly and help their comrades if somebody was killed or wounded, or somebody had some sort of trouble or things like that. The others would all rally round. And I certainly don't remember much in the way of grumbling from the fusiliers. I mean, obviously, they wanted to know why they were 10,000 miles from home in such a godforsaken country. I'd like to talk about the country a bit later. But that didn't really worry them, because they had this marvellous Cockney sense of humour, and, you know, they had enough to do to keep them busy, and they were really a jolly happy lot. It wasn't as if we were sort of out fighting the Chinese on day one and suffering great casualties, although that in a small way came a bit later. So really all that worked extremely well.
And can you tell me about your memories of being in the front line yourself for the first time, please?
Well, I think the main thing really was how one actually lived under those conditions. I remember after about probably a week or so in the line, the company on my right was D Company. That was commanded by a Major Mike Chard, and one night they let fly with all their weapons, and there appeared to be, I suppose they were about maybe 500 meters away to the right, something like that, on their hill, because of course all the positions were obviously on the top of hills, completely dug in, because it wasn't a war of movement at all. Anyway, they let fly with all their weapons one night, and this battle, in inverted commas, seemed to be going on and on. I went round, as one did every night regularly anyway, to see all the soldiers in their slit trenches, in their dugouts, along the adjoining trenches to where the actual fire position was. So walking around there and saying to my soldiers, you know, if you see enemy, if you see the Chinese forming up, well, of course, under the section commander's orders, you engage them or you call down artillery fire or mortar fire. But I said, if you don't see anything, don't for God's sake shoot, in the way they seem to be doing over in D Company. Then the commanding officer got on either the telephone or the radio to me when I got back to my platoon dugout. And he said, Morris, why on earth aren't you engaging the enemy in the way that Mike Chard is? And I said, well, Colonel, you know, or sir, or whatever one called him, no, one didn't say that on the radio, one were on the telephone.